Welcome to Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I love dogs and cats and the people who care about them. Every week, I talk with authors and experts to expand our understanding and appreciation of the animals who share our lives. To hear earlier episodes of this show and download podcasts of other Pet Talk radio shows I co-host with top veterinarians and experts, please go to RadioPetLady.com. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. The birthplace of this show was WPPB 88.3 from Southampton, New York, and I'm proud to have been on Peconic Public Broadcasting for 575 consecutive shows over 12 years. I also produce the annual New York Dog Film Festival, sponsored by the Petco Foundation, and the annual New York Cat Film Festival, sponsored by Dr. Elsie's Precious Cat, benefiting Wynn Feline Foundation. Both festivals are traveling the country, celebrating the human-animal bond while benefiting a local animal welfare group. Learn more at dogfilmfestival.com and catfilmfestival.com. This show is brought to you with the generous support of Waruva, a family-owned pet food company whose owners want to feed their own pets and yours with ingredients that are good enough for people to eat. All the Waruva canned and pouch foods for cats and dogs come in endless varieties to satisfy even the fussiest pets and use the same care and quality ingredients as food for people. The company name exemplifies the Foreman family's embrace of rescuing animals, naming the company after their kitties. W-E for Webster, R-U for Rudy, and V-A for Vanessa. And they are passionate about good nutrition. Their Caloric Harmony dry food for dogs is formulated on the principle of how the body actually utilizes food and the quality of the protein. You'll find Waruva wherever fine natural pet foods are sold. My guests today are the always extraordinary Rita Mae Brown with her newest Sneaky Pie Brown mystery, co-written with the cat called Sneaky Pie Brown, called Probable Claws. It takes a cat to write the perfect mystery. Then I'll be here with Shanna Fest, who has a wonderful movie coming out this coming weekend called Boundaries. It's just hilarious about an inveterate dog and animal rescuer with all kinds of father problems. And investigative journalist Rory Kress will be here with her book, The Doggy in the Window, How One Dog Led Me from the Pet Store to the Factory Farm to Uncover the Truth of Where Puppies Really Come From. But we're going to take a trip back in time, as well as the present day, with Rita Mae, another incredible book. Congratulations, Rita Mae Brown. Your 27th Sneaky Pie Brown mystery, Probable Claws. How do you do it?
You know, I just get older. That's how I do it. And I don't know how that happens. I look in the mirror and I say, do I know that person?
Oh, my God. What is this about the mirrors? You know how when Jews have a death in the family, they cover their mirrors with black cloth? I'm thinking we should all do that past a certain age. Because there's just, I keep thinking, this is a trick mirror. This mirror is like from the bad, not fun house. And I should throw it away. Because it's probably the mirror. It can't be me. Right?
You know, that's where men have an advantage because they can grow a beard and mustache and cover all the wrinkles.
And also, supposedly, it makes them more, I don't know, distinguished or venerable or something. Men tend to get, at some point, look better as they get older. We women, you know, Nora Ephron in the book about the neck, I mean, what could be more true, right? The neck is the big problem. And after you finish obsessing about that, you look up at the rest of it and you just say, me oh my. Now, you have a life which is reflected in your books heavily and mightily in the countryside in Virginia that's very animal-oriented, particularly horse and horse hunting-oriented. Do you find, and your love for Virginia comes through with such eloquence in all of your books, do you find that living in the country and being around animal people, especially horse people, that no one gives a darn if your face kind of looks like orange peel when you're, you know, getting up there?
You know, Tracy, it's interesting that you say that. Yes, that's true. But also, I think because we're so physically active, we literally don't, at least our bodies don't
yes.
age as fast.
That's really,
and
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I look at people in cities, and they're sucking in all this pollution. They're sitting They're under a lot of pressure. And I don't know. I mean, I actually think it's terribly destructive to the body. And out here, I just had a friend who turned 90.
Wow.
He looks divine.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Does he still ride?
He rides.
Oh, my God. I love it.
Who will be 96 this September. She still rides.
Cut it out. Really?
Now, granted, they're not riding as hard as they did. They're not going first flight. But okay. They're out there.
Let's explain first flight, although that's going to be for another day when we talk about Crazy Like a Fox, which is so heavily about fox hunting. But there are not just cats and dogs in the Sneaky Pie Brown Mrs. Murphy's Mysteries, which are cat-oriented, but also horses. And you and I, and I think many of our listeners, share a passion for horses that might, in my case, I can just say, veer into addiction. But really, who am I to talk? I mean, you're surrounded by horses. You live for your horses. You're in the barn most of the time, although how you can be and write all these books, I don't understand. And you're also the master of the hunt. I mean, that's pretty cool. So how is it that, I don't know, that people can keep on riding well into their 80s and 90s, and even following the hunt, maybe not the biggest jumps, but, well, we'll talk about it when we talk about Crazy Like a Fox, because the whole idea of first flight and second flight, it's interesting, because a lot of this language then sort of filters into the regular language, and no one knows that it came from fox hunting. I guess the most extraordinary part about your books, there are many extraordinary parts, but is the back and forth between the 1700s and the current day. And your,
oh, thank you.
Yes, because your appreciation for and knowledge of and illumination of our forebears and how we lived in this country and what our ideas were and what our problems were is such an extraordinary gift, because most of us, okay, I'll speak for myself, totally ignorant really about our history in the detail with which you describe it. Was that one of your very first kind of impetuses for writing these mystery series, of which you now have so many of them, but they all go back and forth in time?
Yeah, now I'm doing it in a more structured way than when I started out. But
right.
Yes, it was one of the impetuses, because I think I truly believe if you don't know the past, you're going to repeat those mistakes. And unfortunately, we are now in a period in our country where people really don't study our history. They just make it up to serve whatever they want.
Yes.
And
even the people that should be correcting them, and we are speaking to people in the highest seats of power, even those people that should be correcting them on their history aren't doing it. It's like we need to have your sense of the importance of it and the reverberation and the illumination of the present with the past is so important.
Our forebears were extraordinary. I'll give you a little, just a little hint of what I deal with, and I think many of your listeners do too. I just got sort of slapped on the wrist for including, which I took out, I understand. I had a little passage in the book I'm just finishing where an African-American lady, extremely beautiful, who admits to being 94, is speaking to the first one of the first African-American ladies to ever walk down the catwalk. You know, a gorgeous model and
okay.
This and that. And they're in Virginia.
And this is modern day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is one of the, and she says, you know, look at all these buildings. They were built by slave labor. And the older lady says, well, my God, so were the pyramids. I mean, what we built lasted forever. And what slaves built, we never get any credit for it. And the fear in New York is this will be taken as my saying slavery was a good thing.
Wow. And you were
That's where we are now.
And you were pressured to remove it for PC reasons?
Exactly. And you know what? I was a coward. I did it.
I'm surprised, because you aren't a coward in any way. You're very bold, and you have African-American characters throughout your books, because your books are set in Virginia, the South, which is a huge part of American history with which slavery is inextricably bound up. So why do we want to make pretend it wasn't? I mean, it's our advances, as well as some lack of advances, that we need to write about, think about, talk about, and feel good or bad about, right?
Well, I'll tell you why I took it out, because it probably should be a longer discussion, and it wouldn't serve the plot to have a longer discussion. Mm-hmm. But do I honor the efforts of our forebears, enslaved or free? You bet I do. I wouldn't be here without them.
Right. And your African American characters are vibrant and real and genuine. One that again, we have to talk about it when we get to the horse book. But I mean, you it's very clear who their real life, when you're writing in the present, their real life sort of inspirations are. And it's great. It's like, yes, there are really interesting parallels and backgrounds to the African American experience from Virginia up to the present day, be it in Virginia or on the East Coast. Isn't that a damn shame? You know, it's funny because one of the things that really interests me to talk to you about, besides the book, and I really don't mean to give it short shrift, it's just that how do you characterize a book like Probable Cause? You know, not only is it a mystery, it goes back and forth in time in a very vibrant way and is utterly delightful. And obviously, I'm going to say obviously, I hope there are some people listening that don't know who Rita Mae Brown is or Sneaky Pie Brown or the Mrs. Murphy Mysteries or your other, I'm sure by now your books really equal 100. I tried to count on all my fingers, counting them up before we got on the air, and I'm like,
I'm into the 60s now.
Yeah, well, at least, okay. So it's a lot of books, and they're not slapdash books. They're thick. They're dense with characterization, dialogue, history, facts, information, and that's one of the joys of them, is that you do go off on an occasional tangent, but it's about weather, it's about the landscape, it's wonderful. It's not just some straightforward, excuse me, James Patterson like plot, 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 plot. You know, there's character and there's texture, everything. But for you personally, as an author, the overview you have of history must be quite something. If we look at the whole LGBTQ movement or moment in America and how you were one of the first voices to speak openly and freely about lesbianism, the queer life, a different way of looking at sexuality and humanity. How does it seem to you now to see this almost in-your-face insistence that everything be, you know, transgender-friendly and bathrooms and schools and everyone gets to, you know, I don't know, declare themselves or redeclare themselves? Does it strike you as, well, I'm glad I lived long enough to experience this, or how does it strike you?
I have very mixed feelings about it.
I'd like to know, because you're one of the real thoughtful people on the planet.
Well, I always joke that I was the first public lesbian in America, and I don't recommend it. I don't recommend it. But where we are now, Tracy, I see this as a numbers game. I do.
Explain.
At best, what would gay people, transgender people, what would it turn into? Maybe 10% of the population, at best.
Right.
And you're going to insult the other 90%? You're going to make demands on them that need to evolve. They can't just happen at the snap of a fingers. You know, and one of the difficult things about falling into any oppressed group, that part of your energy has to be talking to and literally teaching your oppressor to get his foot off your neck.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter where you fall in that scale. Doesn't matter whether it's race, whether it's sexism, whatever.
Right.
The onus is on the oppressor, but the oppressed must take their energy to say, okay, look at this, think about this, this isn't right, nor is it profitable, which really gets through.
But of course, with any oppressed group, or call it a minority, I guess it's usually minorities, that moment where you have a voice and have felt voiceless for so long can be very loud and strident and maybe counterproductive.
Yeah, well, all the anger comes out.
Yes.
For so many people. I mean, the rage. I understand it.
Yeah.
Boy, do I understand it. I mean, I still have it sometimes,
well,
but I just shut up.
Because it doesn't help the people that you would like to mellow, that you would like to soften their edges to make the whole universe a little more inclusive.
Exactly, Tracy. I mean, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar.
Yep, and your books are very full of those kind of southern wisdoms. There's one in which one scene that comes to mind, and I think, wow, that's unfortunately the advice that probably women should have given each other since biblical times until now, which is this woman's, really admiring this guy, Do-Re, and wants to hook up with him, so to speak, although this is not the terminology you use. And the other character says to her, yeah, well, the only way that a woman can really get what she wants is to make sure the man thinks it was his idea. Now, that's totally sexist and totally true.
You know, isn't it ever?
Yes.
Honest to God.
Yes.
Here it is. It's 2018. I'm still doing it.
Okay, so what do you do in a lesbian relationship when both people are female and one person wants to get something done? It's sort of really an idea about salesmanship. Isn't it true of any salesperson? You always want the recipient to go, I have a good idea, and you go, oh, what a great idea, when in fact it was your idea all along, and you planted it.
Well, first of all, I should tell you I'm a failure as a lesbian. I've only ever really had one long-term relationship that lasted 5 years, and I must say, it was easy to talk to, but the people that I'm close to are always easy to talk to. They really are. Where I find the difference in, because I had one very long relationship with a wonderful man, too, I find the difference there is I have to be more careful, because when he goes into the world, truthfully, he is judged more harshly than I am, and failure sticks to him in a way that it doesn't stick to me. Because after all, we're only women. They didn't expect us to succeed in the first place.
Right. So it's gender specific that way. I just want to go back to something you said earlier on. And let's just point out that only very recently did you win two kind of gigantic awards. One might say, belatedly, but the awards obviously just came about. And one was in 2015. You won Lambda, which is do we call it the female gay organization? I don't know what the right PC words are. Lambda Literary's Pioneer Award, and you were, in fact, that first out lesbian literary person. And the 2015 Lee Lynch Classic Book Award for that same book, Ruby Fruit Jungle. What is the Lee Lynch Classic? Is Lee Lynch a famous lesbian that I don't know about?
She's a writer, and she has organized this and put her shoulder to the wheel financially as well as with energy. And it's turned into actually a big, organization to help women write, particularly gay women.
Oh, nice.
It's a lovely thing that she's done. It's just lovely.
So what about we straight women? Can we get encouragement too?
I would hope so. I mean, you know what? Anybody. But it's been harder for women in some ways because, okay, simple case in point.
Okay.
When all of this started to really bubble up in the 70s and 80s, and women have, one of the great things about literacy is once women learn to read and write, they do. So we have.
They just go ahead and do it.
Yeah, they do. I mean, we have Leila, the Dangerous Liaisons from the 1700s. So we slowly have built our way up, but it tended to be about relationships. It tended to be about the woman's world, which makes perfect sense.
Right.
But now I am looking at women saying, "You need to write about military history. Do you understand that? You need to write about the whole world now." We're not as held back as
right.
we once were.
Right.
So I don't really need to hear about your divorce.
Yeah, or your summer at the beach and how you women all bitched at each other about your first world problems. Yeah.
Well, and will there be wonderful books like that? I mean, Dottie Benton Frank writes the funniest stuff in the world about women together. I mean, let's just say women of a certain age together, and she's really right on.
Cool.
And, I mean, there are people that can do it that are hysterically funny.
Yes.
But I want to look at the young and say, no, go after mm-hmm. the areas. Well, there was just a woman, Lyndall Roper, the first, I think, which would say head of the religion department at Cambridge University in England, who wrote this massive tome about Martin Luther. That's the kind of stuff
right.
that I get excited by, because the men can't discount you. They can try, but they can't.
Well, what about Laura Hillebrand? Right? I mean,
yes.
Fantastic
books. Good or what?
She's so good or what? And wrote the whole thing lying in her bed suffering from like a mono kind of disease. It's like, really? And all that? And that too. Yeah, women should definitely embrace every kind of book. Before we run out of time, I just want to say that, yeah, Sirius is good and history is good, but if you want to get a little military history and a lot of fun and a lot of animals talking to each other in a way that you think, oh, sure, that after a while you forget it's a cat, at least I do, is you've got to read Probable Clause, the new Mrs. Murphy mystery, because... Well, there have been 26 others of them, which is a little clue that maybe a lot of you have already embraced these books. And if you're late to the party, the beautiful thing is it's never too late because they're all available in this marvelous world we live in of modern technology. Rita Mae, I just always have such an amazing time talking to you. Always wished I was your neighbor in Virginia. I would totally be the scaredy cat in the second flight of horses. I always was the hunter in the show ring, not the hunter in the hunt field. But you're an amazing woman and a great beacon of light and joy to all of us, both on and off the page. So thank you so much for this wonderful book. And I look forward in the weeks ahead to discussing your most recent, I guess I call it a dog mystery, which is not the right way of putting it, Crazy Like a Fox. So we'll be back with you in a few weeks. And thank you so much for all that you do on behalf of the animals that you give voice to.
Oh, thank you.
I'll be right back after this quick word. This show is made possible in part by Precious Cat Litter, owned by Dr. Elsie, who has his own cats-only clinic in Colorado. He has devoted his life to inventing innovative litters for the health of all members of the family, dust-free litter and cat-attract litter that has herbs which draw the cats into the litter box. Now he has created healthy, dry, and canned food for kitties called Clean Protein, inspired by the protein levels found in a cat's natural prey. 90% of the protein in Clean Protein kibble and cans is animal-based, not the plant-based ingredients in most dry cat food, like grains, potato, vegetables, and fruits, which can actually increase your cat's hunger. The high biological value proteins in Clean Protein result in your cat's appetite being satisfied longer without compromising her health, making this a healthy dry food for your cat, even as a part of her diet. I am here with Shauna Feste, whose movie is opening this coming weekend. It's called Boundaries. If you never go to the movies, make this the one movie you see. If you go to the movies all the time and wonder why you went to all the trouble of going, Boundaries is going to reignite your faith in cinematic experience. Shauna, what a fantastic movie that you not only directed, which is huge, but wrote it as well. What an amazing, funny, touching, original, oh my God, now I remember why I love movies kind of movie. And there's dogs in it too, so how can we go wrong? Congratulations.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
I hope it's going to get all the acclaim that it should and lots of nominations and awards, which seems a million light years from when you started to make it, I'm sure. But it's just utterly delightful and delicious and full of surprises. You also have a really impressive cast. You're not a first-time director, but it's the first time that your work has come to my attention. How did you get these great actors? Do you think it was the brilliance? I know you're not going to say the brilliance of your script, but as a screenwriter, I can say the brilliance of your script. Is that what did it? Or do they know your other work?
No, I think it definitely had something to do with the script. I think that most of the actors that I cast weren't all comedic actors. So when they read the script and thought, oh, this is a chance for me to be funny. Okay, this is a chance for me to do something different. And then as soon we cast Chris and Vera first. And once they came aboard, it was so easy to cast the rest. Everybody wanted to work with them. Yeah.
And when Shauna says Chris, she means the great Christopher Plummer. And when she says Vera, she means Vera Farmiga, who is one of those actresses that you see over and over, not always in a leading role, and think, wow, she's really got something special. And you've given her a platform that I can see now why that would be interesting to actors. We all know that the comics want to do drama and the dramatists want to do comedy and often are not very good at it. But boy, either they were already good at it or you found their funny bone, because the movie is completely funny. I mean, I watched it alone and laughed out loud, which is a pretty big compliment, because, you know, you usually need a whole theater full of people. Talk a little bit about whatever the personal part was about the the woman and her father relationship, but also the rescuing of animals and the filling of one's life with rescued animals and the fact that rescued animals seem to be have a magnet to this woman. It's so funny, yeah. But we all know these people. It's like, I couldn't help it. The dog was blind and wandering in the middle of the road. So talk a little about your own personal life that led you here.
Sure. Well, you know, it all started with my father. You know, my father was a wildly charismatic man. He, you know, women, dogs, cats, and children just kind of flocked to him. But he broke the law, nonviolent crimes, but he was a weed dealer for most of my life and always getting into trouble, in and out of prison. And we had a really complicated relationship. I loved him with all my heart, but he was in and out of my life. So I had a lot of anger that I didn't really express.
Right.
And so I wanted to write a story where I could really get out that anger and also see my parent for who he really is, because he has a lot of wonderful qualities, one of which is he's a huge animal lover. So I grew up with tons of animals all around me. I am that woman who keeps, you know, extra leash and dog food and my running shoes in my car, because I'm literally a stray dog magnet. Actually, sometimes they're not even strays. Sometimes I'll just pull over and I'll try and get a dog in my car, and, you know, the owner will come out and be like, what are you doing? That's my dog. That's happened more times. One time I tried to get a coyote in my car, in the dark, not knowing.
Oh,
it was,
my goodness.
I thought it was a little puppy.
Oh, my goodness.
But, you know, I started out wanting to make her an animal rescuer because I thought, how great if I can shine a light on something that I feel so passionately about. And if everybody watches this film and just has the tiniest urge to rescue an animal, rescue a cat or a dog as opposed to buying a purebred, then my job is done and I'd be happy.
Really? Is that really seriously one of the most important things to you about the film?
Well, it actually, yeah, I mean,
wow.
People ask me that question all the time, like, what do you want people to take away from this film? And I say, I want them to rescue a dog.
Oh, my God, you really
are. Rescue a cat.
You really are very far gone, Shauna. I would say that the movie, and I'm obviously immersed in the dog world and the rescue world, is about forgiveness of complicated parents and trying to get the most out of them that you can as an adult in the best sense, and forgive mm-hmm. all that old hurt that everybody has a bucket of. Some people's bucket is just larger than others. But I think the restraint with which you wrote and directed the scenes between Vera Farmiga's character and Christopher Plummer's character was astounding. I mean, those moments in real life, and therefore in theater, if you will, can be so heavy-handed and so dramatic, and these are so genuine and real. And it was a combination of the writing itself, which is restrained and leaves so much out, which is what's great about movies, right? What isn't being said is shown on faces or body language. The way in which it's delivered, I found it very touching. I have lots of father issues with a father long gone. He wasn't in prison. He hung out with Hemingway his whole life, and I'm sure there were lots of women involved as well. It doesn't really matter why the father comes and goes, but the coming and going of a charismatic paternal figure is really complicating. Are you in or are you out?
Yeah.
Do you adore me and love me?
Yeah.
Am I your sweetie? Or you forgot all about me and my birthday and you didn't call. And, you know, I think many people have some moments of that. I know some of you out there have some kind of normal parental relationship. It's very baffling to those of us with complicated backgrounds. I think that the way you deal with it is so great. And she's not depicted as a nutcase, but she's a nutcase. I mean, the scene where she has a lover in the beginning is so damn funny. Has that ever happened to you before?
Well, that was yes, that was definitely autobiographical.
So,
before I was married in my dating years, you know, I just thought it was wonderful that I was surrounded with so many animals and there were so many animals in my bed, but it apparently wasn't very sexy.
It's just a great scene, and the actor just has that one scene. He's absolutely tremendous, and so there she is in bed, and there's all these halt, lame, and blind, large and small dogs and a huge fluffy cat, and the cat's, you know, all over something else. And he said, it's just, he's trying to find a way to leave. And I think the last word he says, it's just disgusting. But he was trying to find a way to say, you know, like not for me or good for you.
Yeah.
It's great. I'm sure many people listening are like, yeah, what's the problem with six or seven animals in the bed? Just, you know, use your feet, move them over a little when you get to the interesting part with the human. How does your husband feel about your rescue, the rescue side of Shauna Feste?
Well, he had to get used to it very quickly because whenever he would come home, you know, there'd be a new set of kittens in our shower or someone new in our bed. But he, you know, I think honestly why I gravitate towards animals, and this is a little bit in the film too, is, you know, any kind of childhood trauma, I surrounded myself with animals because I knew they could never hurt me. And they just were all love.
Yep.
And I think it was so healing. It's always, I mean, right now as I'm talking, I have a cat and a dog on my lap right
now. No kidding.
And that was what was so amazing about making a film with so many animals as our co-stars, is it really changed the dynamic on set. Everybody, you know, was petting a dog. It was very relaxing, or had a cat on their lap. Or,
nice.
You know, the energy that animals bring to a set was really unique, and I've never experienced it before, but it was really cool.
So do you foresee ever making another film without animals in it? It seems like now that you've released this passion point for yourself, it's like, and the next one will star. I mean, do you see that you could have animals thematically in other films that you are either working on or inventing in your head?
Well, especially if they are, you know, autobiographical, which I tend to write a lot. But I will say, it was not easy having so many animals, because the animals that I wanted in my film were animals that, you know, were just part of their life. So they were either sleeping or lounging or being very naturalistic. You know, a lot of the kind of performance animals in movies are catching a frisbee or doing a flip or doing some sort of trick, and that's not what I wanted at all. So there were times on set where, you know, when we wanted all the animals to be just lying in bed, we'd have to wait about 30 minutes.
Wow.
And everybody would be very quiet on set. No
wow.
one would be allowed to talk. And we would just wait for the animals to kind of naturally fall asleep. And then I'd whisper, okay, let's go. And we'd start shooting, you know?
Well, you know, that's interesting because so many of the trained animals, almost all of them, if you're alert to these things, you see them looking for a cue from their handler. So they're supposed to be doing such and such in the scene, but you can see their attention, their ears are pricked, their body is at someone off camera, out of the line of the camera, but in the sight line of the animal, telling it, if you will, you know, like obviously not with words, what to do. And it has that sort of fake Disney-ish quality.
Mm-hmm.
By the very nature of it. Did you by the rules of movie making have to have wranglers there and the American Humane Association and all that?
Yeah, we, you know, in every car scene there's probably like two or three animal wranglers at their feet, you know, the
actors' feet. Oh my goodness. Really?
You know, all the that part was pretty intense because we had to fit a lot of people in that car and
I had no idea, because the car's not exactly roomy. And the kid, who's a fantastic actor, I'd like to ask you about him, he's often squished in the back with an animal or two. And, I see, because at one point, now that I hadn't thought of it before, sometimes the animal's head is out the window and you had to have a wrangler, like, holding a paw for safety.
Yep.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't
that
something?
And they always have their leashes on, which, you know, I don't know anyone who puts their you know, dog's leash on when they go on a car ride. So I was kind of like annoyed by that. I was like, oh, this doesn't seem very natural if they all have their leashes on. But that was definitely one of the rules that we had to abide by. In the car, the animals always had to have their leashes on.
They're so strict. I mean, like with any rules, they're there to protect against abuse. But sometimes they make someone whose abuse being the last thing from their mind, they kind of get in the way of the creativity. Tell a little bit the other films that you've made leading up to this one.
Well, you know, the first film I made was called The Greatest, and it was about grief. My father lost his second son. It was before I was born. So I grew up with a grieving parent, and I wanted to write about that. It was a personal film. Country Strong was all about my love of country music and those long car rides, all those long road trips that I would take with my father, and we'd listen to country music, Willie Nelson, Loretta Lynn, the whole way. And then Endless Love was actually the first kind of bigger studio film that I did. And I think about it fondly because it paid for my house and it paid for me to do IVF. And, you know, it gave me a nice, comfortable, you know, amount of money so that I can do something that I really, really cared about. And that was this, that was Boundaries. And when I wrote Boundaries, I was kind of struggling with my voice because on Endless Love, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And
was it based on the Scott Spencer novel?
It was.
Oh my goodness!
Yes.
Congratulations on having. Well, I know because that was a very difficult one to adapt. I would think. I happen to have loved the book. Yeah. I was sort of young and impressionable at the time. Wow! So you got a big fat studio picture because that was a book with a lot of buzz around it at the time.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful novel, and mm-hmm. I wish this movie, I could say it was closer to the novel, but it just isn't. I mean, I think if you were a 13-year-old girl, you might be really congratulating me right now, but not a lot. That was definitely the demographic.
Yeah, I understand.
Not a lot of other people saw it.
That's a shame. But, I'm going to go dig it up somewhere because I'd love to see.
No.
Yes, because it's when you discover a writer-director with the kind of confidence and the kind of style and voice that you found in Boundaries, it's like, well, my God, what were the baby steps or the big steps that got them there? It's really impressive. It's sort of like, oh, you know, you're an overnight success with this movie. I really do think it should get an amazing amount of attention in the sense of these small indie pictures that have such power and such genuine connection to the human experience. So how great for you that you could have IVF and children and a house and the freedom to make the movie that was in your heart and mind. That's some Endless Love right there, right?
You know what? I'm so grateful that I got to make this movie because, you know, it was a low budget and we shot, you know, 10 to 15 pages a day.
Wow.
And Christopher Plummer memorized 12 pages of dialogue on average per day.
And he's how old, Shauna? He's in his 80s, yeah?
Oh, he's almost 90. Yeah.
My God. And you have Peter Fonda in the movie. And when you first see Peter Fonda in the movie, you go, oh, my God, I can't believe it. It's Peter Fonda. Is he still alive? And he's not just still alive. He's so wonderful in this great part that just seems custom made for him. You really did score some brilliant casting. The young man who plays Vera Farmiga's son, how did you find him?
His name is Lewis McDougall, and he's a Scottish actor. And, of course, when I watched him on tape and I fell in love with him because he just looked like a kid who had been through a lot but had these incredibly empathetic eyes, mm-hmm. an old soul for sure. And, you know, my producer said, please, Shauna, isn't there anybody else in California that you like? Anybody even in New York? Anything,
please, America.
States. Yeah. And I said, I think it's Lewis. It's got to be Lewis.
Wow.
So we got a visa and flew him out, and he mastered an American accent, which was pretty amazing in such a short time. And I'm so glad I fought for Lewis because he's such an old soul, and he's so, I can get lost in those eyes.
And his way with the animals is fantastic.
He has a real natural
way with animals when he's holding them and touching them and talking to them. You forget it's an actor, at least I did.
Yeah.
It's like, look at this great animal-loving kid. Where'd she find him, at the local shelter? I mean, clearly not, but I mean, the animal part is so much a part of this, and yet for me it's really about communication and love and hurt amongst all these family members who are doing the best they can. And everybody's best doesn't always measure up to somebody else's expectations or hopes or dreams. But it's a beautiful movie. And the animals are clearly part of it. And even though she seems a little extreme in her rescue efforts, she's one of many. I mean, she is not one outlier. And you understand how it's healed her and how it's helped her to heal. And there's just one line, if I'm right, in the movie where her son says, now I see why you rescue animals. That's it. It's just said in a mm-hmm. very low key, no high drama, no big, you know, clanging mm-hmm. cymbals way. And you think, yeah, and that's a really good thing for her. That's really worked for her. And on some level worked for the father as well, because he jumps right in. Shauna, congratulations. I hope it does great things. And just as importantly, that it gives you the freedom to do more of the same. It's really a great triumph.
Oh, what an honor. Thank you so much. It was lovely to talk to you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And to you. I look forward to everyone seeing it. We'll be right back after this quick word. This show is brought to you by Halo, holistic and humane natural dog and cat foods, which are made with only whole meats, never with rendered chicken meal or byproduct meal. There are new formulations at Halo which reflect whole, holistic, and humane practices. Halo says no to factory farming, no to growth hormones, no to antibiotics, no to artificial flavors, coloring, or preservatives in their foods, and sources cage-free poultry, pasture-raised beef, and wild-caught fish. The new Halo has no GMO vegetables. All fruits and vegetables are sourced from farmland that prohibits the use of genetically modified seeds. What's new about Halo will matter to you, to farm animals, and to the planet. This show is also brought to you by Best Pet RX, a unique compounding pharmacy for pets in New York City. They can turn any medication for dogs and cats into a custom-flavored oral paste, chewable tablet, or liquid. And if your pet won't take it, they'll keep making formulas at no extra charge until you get one your pet does like. So your pet can happily take the medicine she needs to get well and stay well. Best Pet RX. I am back with Rory Kress and her absolutely amazing book, The Doggy in the Window, How One Dog Led Me from the Pet Store to the Factory Farm to Uncover the Truth of Where Puppies Really Come From. Rory, you have rather an engaging day job. You're producing your own television show. You were a producer on the Today Show for a long time. How did you possibly find the time to do this research, thick and heavy and deep book, looking into where and how puppies are farmed?
That's a great question. I actually devoted 2 years almost entirely to this project. So this was after I left Today's Show and moved out to Denver with my family. I started digging into this topic a little bit. I was freelancing as a journalist and looking, you know, for my next story. And
right.
Writing a book was something I always wanted to do. And this topic, you know, as a journalist, when you start digging and
yes.
the questions lead to more questions, then you know you're onto something. And then I just fell down the rabbit hole, so to speak.
Well, it's an amazing rabbit hole to go down with you because, oh, we who think we're woke, as it were, well, yes, puppy mill dogs and pet stores are no good. And yeah, that's not great. And oh, the conditions are pretty unpleasant. But what you yeah. spend a great deal of the book going into, which I think is really salient, is the whole concept, idea, which you put on its ear, that the USDA is actually inspecting dog breeding operations and that their inspection means anything at all. Let's
right.
talk about that aspect, because while I don't think that your average dog buyer, as opposed to adopter, that your average dog buyer really understands, do any of us really, the difference between the USDA, the FDA, the
right.
FCC. It's all these acronyms for government agencies that are supposed to keep our spinach safe and what else.
Right.
There was this moment in time not that long ago where the people in the pet industry, I guess in some sort of a partnership with the U.S. government, said, oh, don't worry, because if the USDA
right.
gives the seal of approval to these breeding operations, you got nothing to worry about. It's all good. So talk a little bit about how you went from buying your little girl Izzy to finding out just how not good it is.
Right. It's the USDA stamp of approval means a lot to the consumer. It meant a lot to me when, you know, I admittedly bought a dog. I was told, oh, these aren't puppy mill dogs. These are USDA certified breeders. They have paperwork, not AKC paperwork, but USDA paperwork. The federal government inspected this place.
Right.
You are good to go. And as a consumer, you hear what you want to hear. You know, I trust the USDA to tell me what milk I drink, what eggs I
right.
buy, what, you know, it's something that we have been trained through our entire lives to say, okay, this is good. This is something that is okay. And when we think of puppy mills, we think of the late night infomercials. We think of, you know, illegal facilities that cannot possibly be regulated. But we're wrong there, because millions of dogs are produced legally under USDA supervision in this country. And I think that that's something, there are so many people out there, you know, hashtag adopt don't shop, who have no idea that their dog in their home came from a puppy mill, because in their mind, they may have bought that dog from an online breeder and think, oh, well, it was, you know, a good breeder because the pictures were good. Yeah, but probably not. You know, there's so many barriers to entry for the consumer to have transparency of where their dogs actually do come from. And that's something that the system thrives on. So I think when I started speaking to people, even people who are, as you say, informed on this topic, they were shocked for the most part to find the USDA is so either complacent or complicit in this process.
And I think one of the most valuable things you point out, even though it should be obvious to all of us, particularly if you're paying close attention to what letters and acronyms stand for, United States Department of Agriculture. So as you point out, with fantastic research into the history of factory farming of all kinds of creatures in the U.S., an agriculture department is there to support the agriculture industry. It's not there to worry about the welfare of the animals being raised, as opposed to a corn stalk, an actual pig or chicken or beef cattle, or even a milk cow, nor does it have any obligation or interest in the end user, the consumer. That's not their intention. They're there to support the industry, to keep it moving, moving. And I think that you also talk about, which had never crossed my mind, terminology like a kennel. Talk about the interesting difference in, I've never thought, oh, gee, kennel is a positive word, whereas farm is a negative word. And talk a little about that. It was a great semantic differentiation you made, because you personally went to many of these factory farms, these dog factory farms.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that, the use of the word kennel versus farm.
Oh, absolutely. And semantics are everything, too, in this argument, I should say.
Yes.
You know, what is a dog? Is it livestock? Is it not? So words actually hold enormous meaning for the legal protection of these animals. Are they a companion animal or are they a breeding animal? Well, that's not just a difference of a word, it's a difference of whether mistreating it is a misdemeanor or a felony. So the choice of a word is very potent. In terms of kennel, this was something that came to me from an undercover source who asked me to call him Pete. And he has been, you know, working undercover in factory farms as well as puppy mills. He also does, you know, food farms as well. And he almost was outed. And this was an incredible story to me. When he was undercover for months on end in the Kathy Bauck operation, which was later dispersed and she was brought to trial, he was with the other farmhands, and he said, okay, let's go check on the kennels. And all the other farmhands looked at him like he was nuts. Like, dude, what are you talking about, the kennels? You mean the farm? You know, because in his mind, dogs go in kennels. A kennel is a carrier. It's a place where a dog is kept. To them, these weren't kennels. These were farms. These were farmed agricultural commodities.
Mm-hmm.
They were livestock. And, you know, as I say in the book, with livestock does come dead stock. And
that was a great line.
No one could have been more true. And certainly at that farm, that was the case. The Kathy Bauck operation is particularly interesting. And I was very lucky to have spoken to Pete, who was undercover there and was instrumental in bringing her to justice. And I put justice in air quotes. Because
nothing came of
it. She was able to argue that her breeding animals were livestock, and therefore her mistreatment of them, she was charged with torture and animal cruelty, was a misdemeanor, not a felony. And she walked relatively with a slap on the wrist and was allowed to keep some dogs. And it's just a sad story from there. So words very much do matter in this industry in a life or death way, really.
Yes. And you know, the Kathy Bauck breeding story, I'd forgotten all about it. It got a lot of press at the time, and people online and even, I'm sure, on the Today Show or Evening News or something saw footage of, if it's the right one, where they wash these dogs by dunking them in some horrific, like, chemical bath, and their eyes and their ears, and they dunked them in that and dunked them in something else, and they were treated like maybe like a machine part, not even like what you'd think of maybe as what a factory farmed animal was treated like. But it was very interesting when you pointed out that to us consumers, just regular humans, the word kennel actually has a positive association, which never cross my mind. That was very clever of you to realize that there's a value in it.
Right. It means you're dealing with a dog, right? That it, whether or not it's positive or negative, it just means you're dealing with a dog, as we think of dogs, as an animal that lives in the home, that has a den. You know what I mean? It's not where you put a factory animal. So that association is a strong divide in our minds, and one that doesn't cross into theirs.
And but you also said we think of taking our dog to a kennel to be boarded. We don't think of it as something negative. It has some positive sort of caretaking association, just that word. It's funny when I – funny, not funny, haha. When I was reading the book and rereading about Kathy Bauck and this undercover guy who obviously had to witness some horrific stuff in order to stay undercover long enough to get video footage and to get documentation – that everyone had this sense of moral outrage about Michael Vick. Oh, my God, he tortured these dogs. They were kept on a chain in these houses, and they were made to fight. But these factory farmers, these dog factory farmers, treat dogs with at least an equal sense of that they are inanimate objects. You talk about the way that they were put down with a bullet to the head with a picture of where the dog should be shot and some, you know, dogs at end of life stage from mistreatment, and the guy that was going to put them to sleep, shoot their brains out, took his sweet time. I mean, these people have a kind of amoral insensitivity that's as astounding as someone with a dog breeding operation. And the way you depict them and see them it's stomach turning, but it's important that we understand that.
You know, and it's interesting, when I was writing the book, there's been a lot of literature that dives, not just literature, but documentaries and exposés and television programs that dive into just the horrors of the industry. And when I wrote the book, I made as much of a careful decision as I could without ignoring those realities, which are very much in place, to not go too deep into them.
Yes.
Because I think I didn't want the dog lovers who I hope will read the book and hopefully become more educated about it to feel so wrapped up in that world. I wanted them to focus on the outrage and the very, very strong outrage at our government, at the laws, at what's on the books, at things like the Animal Welfare Act, which in name sounds lovely, but in truth is not when you actually read it and you dive into the science behind it. That these moments of cruelty, you know, I point out that they're out there for people that want to go into them, but, you know, for the most part, try to, you know, steer more to the story that hasn't yet been told, which is why that behavior that is so ugly is legal and actually allowed by our government.
And another thing about inspections, which, I mean, I think everyone should be as cynical as humanly possible about, is that you point out what I also know to be true from what I've been told by those on the receiving end of the AKC inspections of kennels, which is that I think there's 68 or 69 AKC inspectors, and how many thousands of dog farming operations, call them millers, call them puppy breeders. They're farming operations, and you witnessed and got information about a lot of the condition of these animals' mouths and their feet and their bodies and their coat. The sense that these inspections are completely absurd. The inspectors let the facility know when they're coming. There's a cleanup that goes on.
In some cases.
Well,
in some cases.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you only have so few inspectors and these farms are far apart, you don't want to get there on a day when you can't have access. So it's not just to be a colluder that the inspectors do it. My understanding is it's a practicality. Well, we're going to be there on Wednesday.
Some cases.
You know, it's like a UPS delivery. There isn't a time for a sneak attack. And then, as you point out in the book, and then when they come and something that doesn't look at all like water is considered water for the animals, either the delivery system or the condition it's in, the inspector says, you should really fix that up. And and then I won't, you know, fine you. Not that the fine seemed all that egregious. Everyone's work seemed to continue on unabated. I think the book really exposes that the idea that there is an inspection process, the inspections are so few and far between, maybe once a year, maybe announced or not announced, and have no teeth when the inspector comes there. I mean, it's almost like a play, you know, characters in a play. There's no real desire or it's not really the job of the inspectors, it seems like, from what your books, you know, uncovered, to try and shut down bad operations. It's just to try and improve them a little bit if you can. Would you say that's about right?
It's interesting that you touch on this today, because within the last month, one of my contacts at Humane Society provided me with a letter that they intercepted just in the last month that was sent to the licensees, so breeders, exhibitors, transporters of dogs, saying that they were considering piloting an announced inspection protocol as opposed to unannounced, which it technically is now on the books. So instead of, you know, whether or not they are calling ahead and, you know, I can't prove that in every case they are, now actually piloting a program where they do call ahead. Now think about it. You know, the local diner that you go to that has an A inspection, health inspection record that you trust to eat at, would you still trust that A if you knew that those inspectors had called the kitchen before so they could clean up, take out the trash, hide the roaches, you know,
yes,
all that mess?
Yes.
You know, you wouldn't want to eat at that restaurant. That A wouldn't mean anything to you. So now when we look at this regulatory structure and this infrastructure that is in place, and by the way, you, me, and everyone listening to this show in the United States is funding with our taxpayer dollars,
right,
is suddenly being further detoothed. And what's more, in that letter to licensees, which I posted on my Twitter page so people can actually see it and read it for themselves, it says the effort is in part to improve compliance. And, I read that sentence multiple times, and I've seen that in USDA literature before, and I thought, why are we trying to improve compliance? If they are not compliant, fine them. Shut them down. They are not fit to do this job. If there are only two breeders in the entire country who can be compliant, okay. Not everyone should be breeding. Maybe no one should be breeding. I don't know. But if your effort is to try and help people become compliant who are routinely non-compliant, that seems like a strange relationship between regulator and licensee, don't you think?
Yeah, extremely strange, and it's what the book shines a very bright light on. I think as a takeaway from the book, if somebody absolutely wants to have a breed or a mixed breed dog that is bred by another human, it seems, we only have a minute and a half left, that the only way to make sure that it's not a puppy farm and you don't have to worry about other people's inspection is to go there. Because most of these places don't want you to come there, which you talk about in the book. They want to meet you halfway or they want to drop the dog off. You need to physically go there and see with your own eyes and ears exactly where the parental dogs are living and how they're living. And that solves the problem.
Correct.
Get in your car, get on an airplane, and if the so-called breeder won't let you come, just shows you some fake pictures online, then they've got something to hide. And if you don't do that due diligence, then it's like going to get a baby from an orphanage where they're all tied to their beds and starving to death, and you're just enabling that system by buying online or buying through an agency. You need to go there in person. Would you say that that's, at the moment, we can't change the laws, and HSUS lobbies and other groups lobby to change laws and justice moves slowly. Wouldn't you say that in the interim, if somebody wants to buy a puppy, that they should go and see exactly where that puppy was bred and born?
I think you're right. Humane Society and other lobbyists are doing great work on the ground, and I commend them to the end and back. I think as a consumer, what you can do right now today is vote with your dollars. And that means in hopefully most cases, don't buy, obviously, adopt. There are a lot of wonderful dogs.
Sure, we
this
know.
Is a life. And here's what's important to me, and I hope I underscore this in the book, and I hope readers feel that. This is a lifelong commitment for the dog. Maybe not for you, but for the dog it is. And so, you know, and this is an animal that's taken us millennia to evolve, co-evolve with us to be what it is today. It took us so long to do that. you should be investing that same kind of care, thought, and effort. You shouldn't be clicking to buy a dog. You shouldn't be impulse buying a dog. Maybe if our behavior and our responsibility were a little bit more acute when we try to acquire the animal, there'd be fewer dogs in shelters anyway because people wouldn't be surrendering them.
The Doggy in the Window is a great job of journalistic reporting.
Thank you.
Opens many eyes, and really appreciate all the years that you put into it, and hope you will continue to do more of the same. Thank you so much, Rory Kress. Really great
Thank
having you on the show. Thanks so much.